So good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to South by Southwest. Particularly, this is the first day of our panels, and this is one of the earliest government track panels, so thank you for coming here and attending. This panel is Get a Warrant, the Fourth Amendment, and Digital Data. My name is Scott Shackford. I'm the moderator for this panel. I am the associate editor over at Reason.com. Issues like tech surveillance and privacy and warrants and government intrusion and investigation into people's lives are all parts of the beats that I cover. I wouldn't call myself an expert, but that's what our panelists are for here, and I'll be asking them a lot of questions related on the current state of tech surveillance and privacy. This is the first of several panels in the government track, and even in other parts of South by Southwest, that are discussing issues of tech surveillance and data privacy and all of those related matters. So we're the one who talks specifically about the Fourth Amendment, but the Fourth Amendment plays a role in all of these discussions that you'll see in other panels, even if they don't get into it. So I figured for this first panel, we should simply recite the Fourth Amendment to start with. Everyone follow along, because this is listed as a moderate difficulty track, so the expectation is that you all know it. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects from unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue, but upon probable cause, affirmed by oath or affirmation, particularly describing the place to be searched and the people or things to be seized. And that's it. Very simple, a little wordy. The basics of it are simply two parts. First of all, the government, as Americans, it's important we have to make that distinction. As Americans, the government cannot simply come into your homes, grab your things, snoop through your belongings, your papers, your files, and detain you or take your stuff without reason. And if they have a reason, they're supposed to go to a judge and get a warrant for it. In reality, how the Fourth Amendment actually applies is very, very different. Law enforcement officers from the local level, your local police officers, all the way up to the federal government, DEA, FBI, have all worked to convince the courts to allow for various exceptions in certain pressing situations, and sometimes the courts have agreed. There's a tremendous amount of Supreme Court caseload defining when certain protections from the Fourth Amendment do or do not apply. But even if, for example, the Supreme Court does not make the kinds of decisions we would like them to make in order to affirm our privacy and our Fourth Amendment protections, it doesn't end there, because the legislative branch has a role to play as well. Congress and even state legislators, when it comes to your local law enforcement, have the authority to craft law and decide, well, the courts have said that law enforcement doesn't have to get a warrant in order to perform this kind of search, but we think they should. So we're going to pass a law. And that's what this panel is about. Last summer, a group of congressmen and congresswomen came together to create what's called the Fourth Amendment Caucus. These are legislators, they're both on the left and the right, who are very concerned that our privacy protections in this new technological age have been degraded far too much, and the government has much too easy access to our data without having to get warrants or even ask for permission or even inform you that they have your data. It's a bipartisan group, almost equally split between the two parties. There are 26 members right now. It was co-founded by legislators on each side of the aisle. On the left, we have Representative Zoe Lofgren, who represents the San Jose area in California, so a very high-tech area. And on the Republican side, we have Representative Ted Poe, who represents parts of Houston. So they are heavily involved in trying to craft legislation that would improve or restore some of our privacy protections that we're kind of losing in this digital age. Now, our panelists here today are experts at advising and informing people like the Fourth Amendment Caucus on how to craft these laws and hopefully return things to the way they were before. And of course, I lost it. But anyway, I'm going to introduce them in just a moment, but I just want to let everyone know we are going to have a Q&A session at the end of this. I will also be keeping track of our Twitter feed. We have a hashtag, #FourthTech, I'll be keeping an eye on. So while our experts are discussing a particular issue, if you have a question that immediately comes to mind, there we go, you can tweet me, my Twitter handle there, @SShackford, use the #FourthTech hashtag, I'll be able to see it up here on stage, and if there's a way I can drop the question in immediately, I'll go ahead and do that. Otherwise, we'll wait until the end and we'll have a typical Q&A session. So with that, let me finally introduce our experts. First, we have from Demand Progress and the director of the Fourth Amendment Advisory Committee, Sean Vitka, a counsel here with the American Civil Liberties Union and very much an expert on surveillance law and regulation, Nima Singh Guliani, and of course, media attorney, expert, internet attorney, and the creator of Godwin's Law, which I believe now has been expanded to cover all conversations, Mike Godwin. And so to start off, I'm asking each of you to just a little bit about yourself, your interest in getting involved with Fourth Amendment protections, and for the sake of our audience and to start off the discussion, I would like you to say two things. First, give us a piece of bad news about the state of the Fourth Amendment in America right now, and two, give us a piece of good news if you can come up with that one. So we'll start with Sean.
Hi, thanks. I guess for how I got involved with Fourth Amendment work, I can actually point to some extent to Mike Godwin over here. I think the first thing that really dawned on me as profoundly screwed up was that the government contends, and statutorily they have backing for this, that after 180 days have elapsed, your emails are not considered private. So that is from the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. It's an arbitrary standard from decades ago that courts have started to strike down in recent years, but which is still reflected in statutory law, whereas an email for, I think, everybody in this room is equivalent to a letter that you might send, which would, in real-world contexts, be protected by the Fourth Amendment and a reasonable expectation of privacy, and the government would need a warrant to get to it. Emails, at least 5-10 years ago, when I started to get involved in this work, they, for some reason, are accepted, which I think points to a lot of things Scott was talking about. For the purposes of a good thing or bad thing about the Fourth Amendment today, I'd love to engage the audience briefly, if you'll entertain me. How many of you care about the Fourth Amendment? Hands up. And everybody's awake. That's awesome news. Most people are awake. How many of you work for tech companies? How many of you have communicated with your company about how you handle user data? How many of you have called your members of Congress?
Yeah.
So I don't mean to skate over the second to last point. That's amazing. In every instance of abuse of privacy that I can think of, companies have been mechanized against the people. And people having those conversations from within is just incredibly important. So thank you all for doing that. And anybody who hasn't or who could do more, it's really a profoundly important way to do it. But I will say that the bad news is that not everybody in this room has contacted Congress. All of us on this panel, all of us who work in DC on this issue, we are trying to argue and make good points about why people should be protecting privacy, your privacy, my privacy, the privacy of people who are actively being targeted in this country. They only listen to us when they know their constituents care. The good news is that we do actually have a large number of people who care about it, and suddenly it's, well, actually in recent years, it's the most bipartisan issue in Congress. And the Fourth Amendment Caucus, I love everybody who's on it. It's almost dead even between Republicans and Democrats, and there are a lot more leaders in Congress on both sides of the aisle. So there's good news and bad news there, but thankfully there's a lot of good news.
Okay. Nima, fill us in.
Sure. My name is Nima, and I work at the ACLU. So the answer is sort of, how did I get involved in this work? And my entrance, I think, was, you know, based in part on some of my personal experiences. I was a freshman in college during 9/11. It was September of my freshman year. And I very clearly saw a shift in how our government treated certain people. When I looked around at my family, when I looked around at friends and their families, all of a sudden you started to hear stories. You heard stories of people who said, you know, oddly, there's a van parked outside my house every day. And it just so happens that my father is the head of this Muslim association. I heard stories of, you know, from my mom and my dad talking about, you know, harassment when they were going through screening at airports. I heard a lot from people who didn't really know what was happening but had a certain sense that they were being subject to enhanced scrutiny. And so I started to think a lot more about, you know, really our national security policy and how it had changed. And I think the Fourth Amendment is a really big part of that. It speaks to when people are surveilled. It speaks to whether they feel free to say things privately or even publicly because they're concerned about government retaliation. And so that is sort of, I think, how I became really interested in looking at the Fourth Amendment, but also our national security infrastructure broadly, and how it was sort of operating vis-a-vis these constitutional restraints it should have, but in many circumstances didn't seem to have in practice. So good news, bad news. I'll start with the bad news. Maybe that's a little pessimistic. But I think that, you know, looking forward, one of the things that gives me a large amount of trepidation is the extent to which the executive branch, and the president specifically, has an extraordinary level of authority when it comes to surveillance and surveillance in the national security sphere. So this is, you know, a little known executive order, Executive Order 12333, and it allows the president to do surveillance in the name of foreign intelligence collection. This collection is supposed to happen outside the United States, but as we all know, in today's world, if I email Sean, my email probably goes and is stored somewhere overseas. And in theory, this is supposed to be an authority that targets foreigners, you know, targets people who are not citizens and are not green card holders. But, you know, just to give you some examples of what kind of surveillance this might have included, tapping of all the, you know, data between Google and Yahoo data centers abroad, collecting of tens of millions of text messages, collecting of all of the phone calls in and out of the Bahamas for weeks at a time. All of this happens under 12333. And I have long had concerns that there's a lot of discretion at the hands of the president to decide how this information is used. There's a lot of, you know, I think, risk that this information gets repurposed for, let's say, immigration purposes, for domestic criminal purposes, to the extent it hasn't already. And so I think that, you know, one of the bad evolutions I think we have is we have a lot more surveillance happening just in the hands of the president, no court oversight required, and I think that we have, you know, not enough controls, not enough protections to make sure that it's not used for the bad purposes that I think it has been used in the past. The positive, I would say, out of all this, and this sort of touches on one of the things Sean talked about, is, you know, I think that technology companies have an increasing role to play in the space, not just CEOs, but the people who work at these companies. You know, in today's age, a lot of our most private and personal data is actually, you know, held by Google or Facebook or whatever company that I'm using, whatever app I decide to take advantage of. And so I think there's an opportunity, number one, to, you know, flex the political muscles, to say, you know, we're companies, here's what we think is important, not just for economic reasons, but also for moral reasons. And second, you have the opportunity to put more ability in the hands of your users to protect themselves, whether that's making it easier for people to delete their data, to control what data is stored, whether that's companies that have taken on the government and challenged their ability to collect certain pieces of information. We now have, companies have this ability to, I think, act as a buffer, act as somebody who can help protect, you know, everyday Americans. So those are my pros and cons. And I'll stop there.
All right, Mike, how about you?
So I got interested in Fourth Amendment issues in an interesting confluence of events that happened here in Austin, Texas, really about almost exactly 27 years ago. I was finishing up law school, and I was interested in, I wanted to be a constitutional lawyer, and I was interested sort of generally in the Fourth Amendment, and I was interested in computers. I was a geek, you know, and I used computers a lot, and I had learned a lot about them. And I was on bulletin board systems in Austin, Texas, and there was a critical case that originated in Austin, Texas, the Steve Jackson Games case, It involved government seizing a bunch of people's computers on the theory that it was that there was some computer hacking conspiracy, but in fact they seized everything. So they were able to look at all of the data on the computers. And of course, even then, because we were on bulletin board systems and we were using email and we were doing things that were private, or we were doing things that were public, but we had some rights to privacy or rights to limits on what government could take, I thought. This was a really interesting case. So I helped publicize the case, and to make that particular piece of it shorter, the publicity about that case led to the founding of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and luckily they hired me to be their first employee. So I've been interested in Fourth Amendment and internet space and digital space for a while, and I owe it all to Austin, Texas, and the University of Texas, and BBSs, and all the weird, geeky things that we have here in Austin. So I could say more about that, but I think I'll break it into the bad news, good news part. The bad news, I think you know, or at least have strong intuitions about, is that, you know, we're all much more tethered to our devices and have much more information in our devices, in our email accounts, on the internet generally, much including private information, than we ever had before. And so if you think about what was happening in Austin 27 years ago with the seizures of those personal computers, that data was so small compared to what's within every device that you're carrying on you right now, and you are carrying devices, you all are. So that's really interesting. That is the bad news is that our government, both the federal government and the state governments, have taken advantage of the fact that we have put so much personal information out there, including private information, in our devices or in the internet, that the government, often for what it considers to be really good reasons having to do with either law enforcement or with national security and intelligence, has pushed the envelope to figure out how they can grab that information. So the bad news is they've been winning. They just win, pretty much since the September 11th, 2001 attacks. But mostly the government has been winning. Was winning these cases even before then, or winning the law or changes in the law that make it easier for government to capture your information, even before then. Because there's always an emergency situation or a purported, you know, emergency situation having to do with crime or intelligence. And that trend, there have been some really helpful exceptions to that trend, notably, you know, cases, you know, ACLU is very active in this space. The Electronic Frontier Foundation is very active in the space, especially doing casework. But as Scott said at the very beginning, it's not just what we do in the courts, but also we expect our lawmakers, we hope that our lawmakers will strike balances that protect our privacy too. And so the bad news is our lawmakers, with the wonderful exceptions of the Fourth Amendment caucus, are not just sort of generally predisposed to reform or protect private digital information either in the internet or on your devices. So that's, we would like to see that change. Now that the President of the United States believes he was unfairly wiretapped, maybe, you know, who knows what could happen at that, you know, now that he's concerned. The good news, so that's maybe a little bit of good news, but in an odd way. But the good news, I think, Nima alluded to it, is that we are becoming more aware of this. We are becoming more aware of the need to protect our private information, not just from, you know, hackers and not just from criminals, but also from government. We know we're beginning to recognize as ordinary human beings that we have so much private information that can be captured easily, that it's easier and easier to wake people up to the need to call their members of Congress and to build a consensus for privacy reform. And I'll say one other thing, which I think is key, and that's that because of our investment in the digital space, in terms of putting our personal information out there on the internet or in our devices, we have to be proactive in protecting privacy. We can't merely just reflexively think our private information is private. And increasingly, people are beginning to recognize this. So that's sort of the good news.
Great. So we've been planning out this panel for months, actually, since long before the election. And I made all sorts of mental preparations as the moderator, because this is the first time I was doing a panel at South by Southwest, so I had it in my head. But of course, Mike warned me not to prepare too far in advance, and what happened last week is exactly why. So I had all of this idea of what the next question was going to be, and then last week, Trump tweets out of the blue that the president is illegally, the former president, Obama, illegally wiretapped him in Trump Tower. So one of the issues with looking what's going on with our president right now, regardless of how you feel about President Trump, and I'm not going to assume that anyone here is either a supporter or an opponent, the way that the media environment and our political environment has become is when something like that happens, the coverage of it tends to coalesce around what it means for Trump. You know, what it means for his administration about how he operates, how much authority he has and what he's able to accomplish. Is this going to hurt him? Is this going to help him? But I think it's important to kind of look back at the issues here because there is a particular legislative train coming down the track that needs to be dealt with. I'm gonna start with you, Sean, and then I'm gonna shift over to Nima for some solutions. What are the sort of the bigger issues? If you pull away from the idea that Trump is the president and look at what's happening there, what are the surveillance and privacy concerns that everyone should be concerned about as far as what's going on with these wiretapping accusations?
It is hard to count the number of privacy concerns one should have in today's age. So I don't want to bypass any of them. The particular tweet that you're talking about from President Trump is distinct. And that's partially because it uses precise legal language. Mm-hmm. Wiretap is a very precise legal term, and makes a very specific accusation, which is that President Obama was personally involved in ordering it, and at least by suggestion, that it was politically motivated. So those are three really important components of that accusation. I don't have any reason to believe two of the three. There is a third component, though, that I think speaks to the larger issues that you're hearkening to, and I'm going to tie this to something called Section 702, which is, I think, what Nima is going to be invited to comment on. Section 702 is an extraordinarily powerful surveillance law, and it is set to sunset at the end of 2017. December 31st, 2017, 702 is supposed to go away unless Congress acts. Nima, I'm sure we'll get into that in more detail. But the context of what Trump's tweet means is very interesting, and I'll compare it to during the debate about the Patriot Act. The media hook that stuck around my circle of friends and family was that people were worried about something called the library records provision. The library records provision was this part of the law that said, yes, you can subpoena for library records, and this drove everybody crazy, in particular librarians, for good reason. 15 years later, when Snowden started to do his release, we found out they were collecting all information, all business records from Verizon in particular, but we would learn from basically every telephone provider. That was the same provision. In 15 years, the thing that drove everybody nuts was change from can they subpoena our library records to are they collecting all business records on all phone calls. That was all done under cover of night. The reason why I think this is relevant for the Trump tweet is when Trump says, Obama wiretapped me, I think if we take away the very precise technical importance of those words, which with President Trump seems to be a reasonable thing to do, and we switch it to a more colloquial understanding, right? Somebody was listening in on me, and I don't know why. These are real concerns that I think most Americans have now. Section 702 collects on so many people, it is hard for me to imagine that President Trump is not reflected in those databases. And one of the reforms that I think Nima will likely mention is about whether or not the government can specifically query the data they collect under 702 for U.S. persons, specifically for U.S. persons. It's it's a law that's designed to target non-Americans, but the intelligence agencies routinely query it for known U.S. persons. And I don't, you know, this is not to defend Donald Trump's tweet, but it is to point out that sometimes things aren't as crazy as they sound, and we have a really important fight coming up at the end of 2017.
Yeah, and also a very interesting to point out here, as someone who covers these issues as a journalist, not 2 days before that tweet started a firestorm, President Trump's administration himself, they told a reporter from Reuters that the White House does not want any changes. They do not want any reforms to Section 702 to these surveillance authorities. So at the same time that President Trump is complaining about being snooped upon, they're also telling the government, we don't actually want to change anything. So it's an interesting sort of contradiction and sort of reminder that how officials in government want to be treated is sometimes kind of different from the way that they would like to treat you. So, but when we're talking about Section 702, I know the American Civil Liberties Union has made several recommendations about what might be reformed to better protect American citizens' rights, their Fourth Amendment rights, and not have their data just kept and retained by the government. So Nima, can you talk a little bit about what some of those recommendations and what the government could and should be doing differently?
Yeah, sure. Before I dive into sort of how we fix it, you know, it's probably helpful to talk about what Section 702 is. I'm sure most of you have the luxury of not spending as much time reading it as I do have to. But I think it's really important to understand the sheer scale of this surveillance authority. In 2011, it's estimated that 250 million communications, electronic communications alone, right? So not including phone information, was collected under Section 702. And most of that information is retained for 5 years. Some of that can be retained for life. So you're talking about an authority where the government collects or holds on to, you know, potentially billions of records in any given, you know, period of time. And this is information where the government can collect it without any sense that the individual that they are targeting has actually committed a crime. The only requirement is that that individual has to live outside the US, they can't be a US citizen or green card holder, and they have to have what the government terms foreign intelligence information. Under the statute, that could be, you know, as amorphous as having information about foreign affairs, right? So if you're a journalist abroad and you report on drone strikes, you could probably be targeted under 702. If you're an activist abroad and you go to protests about human rights, you could probably be targeted under Section 702. And very importantly, all of those individuals' conversations with individuals inside the US are also collected. And one of, I think, the more concerning aspects of this is that the government never goes to a court, either the FISA courts, the intelligence courts, or, you know, a regular court to say, here's the person I want to target, give me a warrant or give me the equivalent. The courts only look at the procedures around the program. So once a year, the government says, here are my procedures, here's how I treat the information, here's how I pick my targets, and they just sign off on that. So you have a program where an enormous amount of information is collected with very little involvement from an independent judicial body. And one of the concerns that I think has emerged is that once the NSA and other agencies collect this information, they assert the rights to use it for things that have nothing to do with national security, have nothing to do with terrorism. They can search through it for information. Let's say they have my email address and they're doing an investigation on me. They can search through the repository for information about me. Information can make its way into criminal prosecutions against Americans. And I think that this raises a lot of concerns that under sort of this guise of national security, under this idea that we need to surveil a lot to protect ourselves, what we really have is an authority that is being abused to circumvent the requirements of the Fourth Amendment. So I think, you know, we have talked a lot about what the things that the government can do to fix some of these abuses. I think, you know, at the front end, addressing the scoping problem. You know, if the government says they need an authority for terrorism, you know, collection should be really confined to that purpose. That's not what 702 does. We've talked a lot about increasing oversight from the courts so that they play a role in determining who is targeted. And I think third and really importantly is limiting how this information is searched for and used, specifically as it pertains to people in the US. In my mind, if the government collects information for intelligence purposes, they shouldn't be able to search through it if they're doing a jaywalking investigation. And right now, the statute on its face wouldn't prohibit that. And so I think that we need to think a lot more about not just how we prevent kind of the front end collection, but also how we make sure that information that we're collecting in the name of intelligence and national security doesn't just get repurposed and used at the discretion of, you know, whatever agency happens to have it in its possession.
Okay. Yeah, and this, again, this is something that Congress has to act on this year. So there's going to be a vote on what 702 can and cannot do. So it's something that if this surveillance authority matters to you, it's something that you definitely have to pay attention to.
Yeah, so all of you who didn't raise your hand, call your member of Congress for the first time.
It's very easy. It's not intimidating, and they like talking to you most of the time.
Yeah.
Let's talk about something that is very particular to Trump, but also preceded him, and that's actually something I want to bring up. A lot of the issues that we talk about really preceded our current president, and there's this tendency, and, you know, when you cover policy, when you cover government, and you see these cycles of outrage, you know, I'm like, where were you people 2 years ago? So, but let's talk a little bit about border searches, because this is one of these things that is happened for a while, and it's become a big deal because of President Trump's attitudes towards immigration and the policies that he's trying to put into place. You may or may not know, I know from traveling here that there are a lot of people here at South by Southwest from other countries. In America, one of the major ways that our Fourth Amendment gets compromised for American citizens, not just for foreigners, is if you're close to a border. So Mike, if you could tell me a little bit about the border search controversy that's going on and the desire by the government to try to search people's technological devices without having to get a warrant.
Right. So one of the difficulties with border searches, and this doesn't depend, or at least doesn't depend entirely on whether you're a U.S. citizen or not, because you come back into the country and everybody who ever crosses borders is potentially subject to different kinds of border-related searches. And the constitutional law on the government's interests in being able to conduct border searches is not, shall we say, hugely great for individuals. It's very much in favor of the government. And the idea here is that, and it predates the digital era, the idea here is that the U.S. government has a particular set of security-related interests that give it broader authority that make these searches more reasonable under the Fourth Amendment. So remember, the Fourth Amendment's not just about warrants, but also about reasonableness. So even searches outside of a warrant, which may be lawful, they have to be reasonable. So we have those two different pieces of the Fourth Amendment language that we always have to think about. The law about borders has not been good, and increasingly, because we carry our devices with us, we're carrying more and more of ourselves in a way that is searchable whenever we cross a border. And people who come to this country do that, and it happens to us as well. I happen to, over the last decade in particular, but certainly over throughout my career, I've traveled internationally a lot. And I come back in the country and I leave the country and I've found myself increasingly thinking about what is on my computer, what's on my devices as I cross borders. Well, our government has historically taken the view that because of its presumed special authority to do searches at border points, they can do more. And if that presumption existed before September 11th, 2001, it certainly has not diminished since then. Mm-hmm. It is still a very strong presumption. So one of the things that we have to do, and it harkens back to a remark I made earlier, is that we can't be passive and just assume that you're going to be, that there'll be limits on what the government does to you when you cross the border. That we have to be very proactive in raising these issues and finding ways to tie border searches back into that language of the Fourth Amendment about reasonable searches and seizures.
Yeah. Now, so Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon introduced or has announced that he's going to be introducing some legislation that's related to phone searches on the border.
Right. So, So Senator Wyden, I think, obviously is picking up on the iPhone. The concern about searching iPhones, which reached the public eye last year. That said, it's important to remember that in the iPhone search case, the fight between Apple and FBI, that was not a Fourth Amendment case. So that's not, the issue was compelling Apple to breach the security of a phone or to assist in the breach of security of a phone. There are a bunch of issues with that, but it's not precisely a Fourth Amendment issue. Nevertheless, it has drawn the attention of people who, of lawmakers, who are more technologically in tune with sort of the present state of affairs. They recognize that we really do need to proactively protect our devices and our information on our devices from unreasonable searches and seizures. And the way to do that, the best way to do it, can be legislative, because rather than wait for cases to progress through the courts, and rather than wait for judges to try to apply old principles to new technologies, although they can do that too, that's good too, we also want to see something happen proactively, and I think Senator Wyden's proposed legislation is an effort in that direction.
Yeah. Can I just jump in on that issue? I think it's also really important to think about border searches in the context of the broader immigration shift we have seen in the administration,
sure.
Right? So when people are crossing the border, it's not just visitors, right? You're going to have people on H-1B visas, on student visas, and that's in addition to, U.S. citizens and green card holders. And I think that one of the concerns that's emerging is, we're hearing reports that people are being asked to turn over their passwords, for example. Or being asked to, have their device search and consent to that search.
Which is real, by the way.
Which is real. I mean, we're seeing
actually
these reports.
The passwords.
Right. Journalists, everyday people are reporting that this is happening. It happened before, but seemingly we've seen an uptick, although there's no data to confirm that. It's still, largely anecdotal. But I think that one of the concerns is that for people, as a practical matter, who are on a visa or who are visitors and are not U.S. citizens, their ability to say, no, I'm not going to, is really difficult, because the government also has the ability to deny entry to people. And that's really scary. As a practical matter, can you be detained for hours? Or even as another matter, could they use that as a reason to not allow someone to enter the country? And so I think that it is really important that we think about it, not just from a Fourth Amendment, I'm an American and they should get a warrant before they search my computer, but also in the context of an administration that has taken a very different view of immigrants, and for which some of these rules can particularly affect these communities, just because the effects and their abilities to fight back are different.
I want to add a little bit just to that, and that's that it's not just people in particular communities. It's very hard for anybody in any in any demographic group to decide to steel herself or steel himself again to say to TSA, no, I will not do that.
Even Americans, there was the situation where they were asking for IDs for people to get off a plane, and
right.
And these were Americans who are like, do I have to? And I'm pretty sure they all did. I don't know if anyone refused.
It's asking a lot of people to sort of say, I'm going to actively resist what TSA is demanding of me when I'm getting on a plane, or when I'm at a border, and that's or Customs and Border Patrol or Customs and Border Protection officers, it's very hard to decide, well, I'm just not going to do that, even if you believe to the core of your being that you are an American citizen and you have all the rights and privileges, and you're not particularly, you know, associated with any particular community as far as you know. It's difficult. So the way to deal with this proactively is to do it from the top down. You really have to put restrictions on what government officials can do in order to make sure that they don't overreach their constitutional authority.
I want to add two things, mm-hmm. if that's okay. So one, and this is just a theme that you've probably all picked up on, the Fourth Amendment does not stop the government from asking your consent.
Right.
It's just a different thing. So it's about what they can force you to do or what they can search and seize by force. If they just ask you if they can search your trunk or for your ID, they just can do it. Feeds into a second point, which I haven't thought actually a ton about before, but I think about it a lot in the context of encryption, which is that herd immunity is really important. And so in the context of vaccines, that's where the term comes from, you hit a certain threshold where it would be difficult for a disease to propagate through a population. When it comes to encryption, you can actually see something similar, right? When you have enough people encrypting things, then the government doesn't have a huge amount of interest in targeting people who use encryption. And that's quite important. And when it comes to other things, like these quote-unquote voluntary measures that people can opt into or not, resisting that is really important for all of us to be doing. Because if the DHS or law enforcement is in a position to just face resistance from the people whom they target, that's easy for them. Those are particularized communities that they can go after in that context. If we are all trying to resist that, if we are all saying, no, you need a warrant, we are not complying with this just because you want us to, we can stop them from having the discretion of applying it disproportionately to certain communities. And that's a really important thing I think we'll be facing more and more.
Something I want to do some audience participation for a moment. I am seeing your questions. We've gotten some good questions coming in. Again, a show of hands, how many people paid a lot of attention to what was coming out from Edward Snowden's whistleblowing and his leaks? Raise your hands. Okay. A lot of folks. Okay. Now, how many folks have ever heard of the Email Privacy Act? Yeah, a handful of you. and I think that's a good illustration of the situation we're in, because the Email Privacy Act is legislation that has already passed Congress, passed the House of Representatives unanimously once, but is not yet law. So, Sean, could you explain, first of all, what the Email Privacy Act is and why we need it?
Yeah, I mean, primarily it's actually what I referenced when I was right. starting, which is modernizing the statutory law around emails such that they're private, revolutionary concept. So the Email Privacy Act has been in limbo, is, I guess, still considered the most popular bill in Congress because everybody, I think there's actually a majority of the House of Representatives co-sponsors it. It passed unanimously, which never happens in the House, 419-0. That's not everybody voting, but there's not a single vote against it. And it passed last year. And really, to some extent, just catching up with case law, which itself took 25 years to get to. But case law says you probably need a warrant, although we still don't have a Supreme Court decision on that. So that's the problem. And the Email Privacy Act is, in theory, a modernization, solution.
But we can't seem to get it through Senate, which reminded me when we, after Snowden's disclosures, there was some modest reforms in the USA Freedom Act. In fact, there's some dispute as to whether it actually reformed very much. But during that fight, it also felt very similar in the sense that the House of Representatives was really pushing for changes, and the Senate leadership, Republican leadership, is very resistant there. So in this case, is how much of a barrier is the Senate to reforming some of these authorities to require warrants?
I think we can all answer that question. I'll do a quick statement, which is a huge barrier, okay. And it's not just the Republican leadership. Democratic leadership could be more supportive. I'm interested to see what they do in 2017. But I think Mike and Nima can probably get into what happened with the Email Privacy Act, but the weeds there are very damning, I think, actually.
Yeah. I mean, I think that fundamentally there's two problems. One is that there seems to be this enormous disconnect between the way most people think about their information and how the Senate and House members actually vote. Like, if you ask the average person and you're like, do you consider your emails, do you consider your GPS location, right, to be private? Most people say yes. They say, I don't actually think the government should be able to track my movements or
without
a warrant, or read the emails that I send my boyfriend or a colleague or an associate. But for whatever reason, I think the urgency and the sense that people feel around their private information in everyday life has not transmitted to members. And I think the Email Privacy Act is a good example. You know, that bill was doing, in some senses, what law enforcement was already doing, what courts had already said. You have to get a warrant to get somebody's email. And in large part, companies were requiring this, and law enforcement was doing this. And it was a sense of codifying this and writing it into the law to remove any ambiguity, to bring the law kind of in line with what people's expectations are. And I think the challenges it faces are that members do not hear from their communities as significantly on these issues to feel the pressure to vote the right way, right? I think that, you know, members of Congress say, I'm not getting, you know, 8,000 phone calls about the need to pass the Email Privacy Act or update our privacy laws. And so I think that when these things come up, often they just become victim to politics. And the Email Privacy Act is an example of that, where you had a bill, it passed the House, nobody voted against it, and it stalled in the Senate. And it stalled in the Senate because, you know, members wanted to use it for their political purpose, to add, you know, unrelated amendments that would kill the whole thing. And, you know, that's a little bit the way DC works sometimes, but it doesn't work that way if members know they're going to get a bunch of angry constituents calling them. So I think that is one of the important lessons learned about the Email Privacy Act, is that, you know, we need to have a lot more people who see the Fourth Amendment and see the problems not just as this abstract idea of privacy, but something that really affects people's lives, really affects discrimination, all these other issues that people are very passionate about, and conveys that to, you know, Democrats and Republicans.
So I've had the experience, and I think a lot of us have had, which is if you work in Washington, is that you'll often go to a member's office, a member of Congress's office, and sometimes you'll run into people representing the FBI or the Department of Justice or the NSA who are also doing a meeting because they are a lobby too.
Yeah.
So the agencies are lobbies as well. And one of the factors, and I just want to make sure this is on the surface, is that the members of Congress who resist reforming or protecting privacy are also lobbied very hard by law enforcement agencies and intelligence agencies to not protect privacy, to basically limit the protections of privacy so that these agencies can do what they believe that they need to do. So it's really important that there be something proactive on the pro-privacy side, because the agencies, who are of course funded by Congress, they go to the Hill every day. You know, they go every day. So members of Congress need to hear the other side.
And to add a little bit to that, and it circles it around a little bit as well, Republican leadership primary Justin Amash after Amash Conyers. Amash Conyers was the first and arguably the most aggressive legislative response to the Snowden leaks. It would have defunded NSA activity in the context of any program that collected information on Americans. And it almost passed the House. It was a very big deal at the time. Republicans resisted Representative Amash over that. They actively targeted him. And that is suggestive of how much support real privacy advocates like Representative Amash need from everybody, including your bosses and you and your friends and your employers.
Okay, let me get to a couple of questions, because we've hit our Q&A period. Do we have a mic for people to... Oh, okay. While I'm getting that, someone asked if how biometrics, and just to keep in mind, the person who asked this, there's a biometrics panel at 5, so I don't want to get too, I don't want to steal too much to them, but brought up in concerns of how biometrics plays into things like these border searches and using biometric information to track or snoop on people, and what Fourth Amendment issues are involved there. And
So let me respond very quickly on that, because it's not just border searches. It's also the fact that in Fourth Amendment law, generally, the courts have often said that stuff that you volunteer to the public or stuff that is visible to the public is people can see it. If anybody can see it, then you shouldn't have to have a warrant to see it. Well, when it comes to biometrics, our faces are pretty public. And so the idea that, for example, searching on my face or searching on Nima's or Sean's or Scott's face, should require a warrant, should not require a warrant. You just have to think, they're capturing our faces a lot in public. I mean, there's a lot of facial recognition already going on. And if you go to a liberal democracy like the United Kingdom, you discover that it's even happening even more there, especially in London, where closed circuit TV monitoring. So there's a huge amount of capturing of our information, and it's just going to become more so that every one of us has a distinctive walk, and it becomes easier and easier to identify people for how they walk or how they move, in addition to whatever your face is or the sound of your voice. They're all things that could be captured. And the question is, how do you proactively limit what the government gathers in terms of saves in terms of biometric information, and then how they query it later, how they query what they've saved?
Yeah. Two creepy examples just to throw out there, and I'm sure people will hear more about this at the biometrics panel. Two things that happened today. In LA, they have real-time face recognition, right? So a camera, and it scans faces that walk by. And right now, they scan it against a hot list, right? So it preloads images that law enforcement has labeled that they're hot list. They don't scan every image, in part because of technical limitations that I suspect will evaporate very soon. Happens without a warrant. Second thing that happens routinely without a warrant is FBI, if they have the face of someone, the picture of somebody, they can run it through face recognition databases. One of the databases is often run against DMV records, right? So everybody has their picture on their driver's license, happens without a warrant. There's no legislation that says how it should be done, when it should be done, and in what circumstances. So I think that just gives you a sense of how this is an area that's developing and how far behind I think our laws are.
All right, so where's our mic? I know someone, okay. Question over there.
So I agree with pretty much everything that's been said and really appreciate all the perspectives. One of the things that I think has happened in Washington and a little bit on the stage, this not to criticize, they are all related, but the distinction between national security surveillance and traditional criminal or civil investigatory authority. So when we're talking about the Email Privacy Act, that's the latter, not really the former. But one of the things that's happened in the Senate, as I say, is that conversation hasn't been made distinct. So the Email Privacy Act seems to be bogged down because of this sort of throwing other, as you said, Nima, the unrelated stuff or somewhat unrelated stuff. So you talked about advocacy. My question is, do you think that ship has sailed in the Senate and we're going to be bogged down entirely? Or can we peel off a few of these small things, both advocacy in Washington, but also public advocacy from the citizenry?
I'm sorry, I hope I didn't cut you off. One thing that I thought was kind of heartening, and this actually belongs, we could have listed some other good news things. One of the things that I think is helpful is the passage in California of CalECPA, which is a state level set of email privacy protections that I think was even better than the Email Privacy Act that was passed by the House and then was never passed by the Senate. I think that it's not that the ship has sailed. It really is what happens in the course when we have privacy, pro-privacy legislative reforms, is that sometimes it's because there's been a growing consensus that privacy needs to be addressed. That ultimately is what led to the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Katz versus United States, which brought wiretapping into the Fourth Amendment context for the first time. And even though there are problems since then, that's what happened. Another thing that happens sometimes is that Congress will become alert to particular issues, and there's a provision in Title 18 which just protects video rental records. And it was after the hearings of Robert Bork, who had been nominated to the Supreme Court, it was discovered that his video, it was possible for a reporter to go to the video store and find out what movies he'd rented. And Congress, members of Congress said, "Oh my God, I rent movies too." What if somebody came and looked at what movies I was renting? And I have no idea what members of Congress were renting. But very quickly, Congress amended, it's actually very close to where the wiretap protections are and the email protections are. Congress amended Title 18 to put video rental records under protection. And it seems sort of quaint now, because who goes to a video store to rent a video? But still, Congress sometimes will respond to particular things. So we have the helpful model of CalECPA, which is a lot of progress in the direction of email privacy. And then sometimes there are specific things that we can also push the button on and get some protection for.
Yeah, and then I want to bring up the California thing. Our focus is on Congress because of the nature of this particular panel. But that doesn't mean, even if we can't get things through Congress, that you can't get things through your state. You're probably more likely, if you're to run afoul of the law, you're probably more likely to run afoul of the law within your own state's law enforcement agencies than, say, the FBI or the NEA, depending on what you're doing with yourself. So state-level reforms are also very, very valuable in retraining the police, restraining the police's surveillance authorities.
Well, retraining, too.
And retraining, yes.
And bottom-up is incredibly important.
Yeah, I think
it really is. Go home and get active.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, there's versions of CalECPA that have been introduced in other states. So if you're from elsewhere, you can look it up and see how you can get involved locally.
Stingrays, if they scare the hell out of you, go local. Who knows when Congress is going to move on them? But
we're talking about the cell phone tracking system and not the animals. But you know, some people are afraid. Yeah.
Yes.
To conclude, I wish we could get into more questions, but our time essentially is pretty much up. But to conclude, let's give everyone some homework. So what specifically should they be bothering their senators and representatives about?
Whatever you care about, really. I honestly find the thing that makes you mad, because that's what they are scared of. Everybody that represents you is terrified that you will primary them or support their opponent or take away a vote or give money to the other person. It scares them to the bone. And if you don't feel represented, that is just the most incredibly powerful tool that you have. And it's not as hard as it seems. It's not as scary as it seems. And it's way more effective than it seems right now.
Yeah. Nima.
So I'll give people two pieces of homework. I think one good piece of homework is, if you work for a company that donates money to members of Congress, I'd encourage you to go to Open Secrets or one of those websites, take a look at the members your company donates to, and if those are members that you think haven't supported things that you care about, you know, whether it's the Muslim ban, whether it's Email Privacy Act, whether it's national security surveillance, press your companies to either cash in on that commitment they made to the members and use it to press them, or to commit to not give money to those members in the future. I think that that's a really important way that employees can get involved in you know, the how their companies interact with the political system. And then I'd say, like Sean was talking about, whatever you care about, I'd encourage people to think about the national security apparatus. I think a lot of times people think, I never hear about 702. I never hear about this executive order. You know, how can they be that bad? Well, you're not going to hear about it. It's secret. But the reality is that I think that it has, you know, if it hasn't already, it certainly has the potential to be abused in ways that are concerning, particularly in this administration where we're seeing rhetoric that labels people of certain religious groups as national security threats, labels, you know, immigrants and immigration as a national security issue. And given our history, where people like Martin Luther King Jr. were targeted for surveillance and called national security threats. Yeah. So I think that those are important things to think about when we think about that distinction between law enforcement and national security. Sometimes I don't think those are as two distinct buckets as we would hope.
So I think just one assignment, because you already have a lot of homework, and that's that every device that you're holding or that you have attached to you right now, take 5 minutes sometime in the next week to just look at everything on it. You probably can't, because you probably can't read every single thing that you have access to. But look, if you have a phone, look at every app and think about what does this app do with the internet? What does it push out to the internet? What does it save on the phone? What's my password? It's always good to know your password. But is my password long enough? You should actually ask with regard to, you should actually think about, if I got pulled over in a traffic stop and the officer told me I had to type in the phone, and officers will overstate their authority. I hope this is not news. And you feel compelled to do it, what would they find? Because that's the border search writ large, and then if you think about kind of more thoroughly about all the stuff that you've shared with your phone or that you store on your phone, you may make different choices. But I will add that one of the benefits, I think, is that the social consensus about your being able to assert your Fifth Amendment rights or your right to an attorney is something that's a modern era development. In 1910, you did not normally tell a police officer that you have a right to an attorney if they tried to arrest you, or they certainly didn't tell you. So I'm going to put that out there.
Okay. And with that, we'll wrap up. I have one last piece of homework for you all. If you don't have the South by Southwest mobile app, you should, because it helps you find panels, and this is a complicated place, and that's all I've learned from this so far. If the subject matter of this panel is important to you, if you look us up on the South by Southwest Go mobile app, underneath our panel, there's a rating. You can rate the quality of our panel. And doing that, if you give us good ratings, I'm not trying to push you into a certain place, but it could well mean that the people who organize South by Southwest will realize that these are issues that are important to the people who attend this conference, and could make it clear to them that they'd like to see additional subjects like Fourth Amendment issues in future South by Southwest. So if you've got time, please do so. I'd like to thank you all. I'd like to thank our guests. They're great. Can we please give them a round of applause? And I believe if you're still interested in these Fourth Amendment surveillance issues, the biometrics panel, I believe, is going to be next door at 5:00.
Thanks, everybody.